You're listening to a Least Important Things miniseries.
Dear listener, your mission, if you choose to accept it, is to rewatch every Mission Impossible movie with Luke Ferris and Mike Wynn. Together, you'll investigate everything from Tom Cruise's running stride to the legacy of this spy action franchise. Good luck. This podcast will self-destruct in 30 seconds.
Welcome to Podcast Impossible, a special rewatch miniseries from Least Important Things, where we accept the mission of watching every Mission Impossible movie leading up to the seventh installment in the series. Our task is to investigate the improbable influence of this franchise on culture, cinema, and Tom Cruise's legacy. With me, of course, is the Luther to my Ethan, my good friend Mike Wynn. Michael Wynn, how are you?
I'm good. Sorry.
You're good. So were you already distracted? Distracted. Not very Luther-esque for Mike Wynn. He's on top of it. And with us today, we have our first guest of the miniseries, our Benji to our Luther to our Ethan, Mr. Zach Hall. Oh. Zach, welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I was thinking I was more of a Billy Baird without the accent. But yeah, thank you for having me on. I know I was, when you guys were doing Jurassic Pod, like, thank you for having me again. I guess I did a good enough job, and hopefully we can have some fun today. So
we're gonna have a blast.
Where the podcast did so poorly with Jurassic Pod that we figured it was an anomaly. So it was like, we gotta test this out. Is it us or is it Zach?
There's something there. We have our control.
I think it was me. I had no clout in the internet world, so like Zach Hall, yeah. Even if you Google me, it's just like a picture of ducks online.
It's a true story. You're so off the grid that the ducks emerge, but that's what we want. You're a true internet spy because you're on the internet, but you're not on the internet. You know
exactly.
You know,
don't know what I do on the dark web.
And I couldn't, Billy, maybe we'll talk about Billy Baird, but I just feel like you're better than that character. It's one of the many criticisms of this movie is the team is not great. But we'll get into all that fun stuff as we go on. Zach, I wanted to start out, what's your walk with Mission Impossible? What's your journey with the franchise? Are you a fan of it or is it just something in the background?
I would say my walk with Mission Impossible, because it's a walk, is only till this movie. I did not go beyond Mission Impossible 2. I love, historically, Mission Impossible 2 is my favorite, at least in my child brain. I watched it multiple times on TV, multiple times on VHS. VHS.
Great VHS movie.
I know. It was great. And it was mostly the poster at first. Like, that charged me to watch that so many times, that incredible Mission Impossible 2 poster. Just so much, so warm, such a warm tinted poster. And for some reason, that caught my eye. It made me rewatch.
That's beautiful. And it's a very warm movie. And it's as I like to say, there's this category of movies that were TNT, TBS, kind of Saturday afternoon dad movies that are embedded in my brain, and Mission Impossible 2 is probably one of the best. Like, I don't think I've actually seen the movie all the way through, like theatrical cut, until we had to do it for the podcast. Like, because I think I watched it so many times in different segments on television, never actually sitting down and watching it in VHS form. Mike, what's your context with Mission Impossible 2?
I don't think I ever saw it until I like went through and like watched all the movies sequentially. I think, and that was probably around the time I was getting ready to watch Rogue Nation.
When you did the rewatch of all of them to prepare.
Yeah. So, the first time I saw it, I was old enough to not be like, enamored by like this childhood innocence. I saw it for what it truly is.
You weren't a fan of the doves. The doves are kind of like the Ewoks for pigeons, the Star Wars franchise, or pigeons.
It's pigeons.
Yeah,
I'm glad we have a real. What's the bird? What's the name of bird people?
Ornith.
ornithologist or something. It's a great name.
Ornithologist. Yeah.
Something about all
the aviation enthusiasts.
We're alienating our bird audience, our bird watching fans.
It's literally in my notes. Pigeons, doves, which one? So I, because it's mostly pigeons, but there are, I think there's some elements of some dove culture in this movie. I'm not sure. I'm not a pro on birds, to tell you the truth.
We might have to get a bird expert just for this film, a bird consultant in the field. Well, gentlemen, as we did in the first one, I'm going to dive into some facts, some information to give us context of our conversation. Hey, and listeners, if you're just tuning in to this episode and you didn't listen to our first one, go back and listen to that. Rewatch the first one. We're doing one every month if you didn't get the hint until leading up to the seventh installment. So if you haven't seen the first one, go back and watch this one. Watch Mission Impossible 2. So Mission Impossible 2 opened up on May 24th, 2000. So we're continuing the kind of end of May Memorial Day trend. Guess what, guys? This weekend, you could have also seen movies like Dinosaur, Mary-Kate and Ashley's Our Lips Are Sealed, Gladiator, Hamlet,
yeah,
and last but actually least, Battlefield Earth, starring John Travolta, also on the table. Oh. Yeah, lots of good options. The movie would gross over $546 million worldwide. That's much larger than Mission Impossible, which was $180 million worldwide in comparison. If you adjust for inflation, it is still the second highest grossing Mission Impossible film. Very interesting. It cost $125 million to make, which was $50 million more than Mission Impossible, and was shot on location in Utah, Arizona, California, and mostly in beautiful Australia, down under. All right, here's the team for Mission Impossible 2. It was directed by John Woo, of course, who made his name in Chinese cinema in the 1980s for stylistic action. His first American feature was 1993's Hard Target, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, another like actor who can be flexible and does his own stunts. And leading up to MI2, he directed two amazing 90s action movies, Broken Arrow and Face Off. So you know what you're getting into when you get a John Woo film. Cinematography by Jeffrey Kimball, who did Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, True Romance, eventually Star Trek Nemesis and the Expendables. That's our first Star Trek mention. Just wait. It was edited by Stephen Kemper and Christian Wagner, who both did Face Off with Woo. And then Wagner went on to go do films like Man on Fire, Die Another Day, The Island, Domino, Fast and Furious 4-8, and the James Gunn Suicide Squad. So the style of the editing, you can see that in all those movies, and it will come to play in Mission Impossible 2. The music was done by Hans Zimmer, who also worked on Face Off with Woo. Crazy, early Hans Zimmer.
And also Gladiator, which came out was in theaters at the same time, which very interesting. I got kind of confused on the score sometimes. I didn't know which movie I was actually watching. So, yeah.
It's interesting because Hans kind of has been criticized for just like he's literally a corporation, but he's been doing that for a while where he's putting out a ton of scores for movies. It was written by two Star Trek 90s people who wrote on Star Trek TNG, Voyager, Deep Space Nine, First Contact, which is amazing. Roland Moore was eventually a writer on Battlestar Galactica. Brendan Braga eventually wrote on 24 and Orville. And then Robert Towne returned for the screenplay. So a lot of Star Trek influence in this film. I mean, wow. I didn't know.
I love it.
I didn't know. It actually helped me frame my mind and enjoy it even more. Mm-hmm. And the film stars, of course, Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt. Is it Doug Ray Scott? I always want to. I feel like I try to say it in an American accent, and it doesn't really work. I have to do it in the Scottish. Like, Doug Ray Scott. Doug Ray Scott as Sean Ambrose. Thady Newton as Nia Hall. Ving Rhames, of course, returns as Luther. Richard Roxburgh as Hugh Stamp. John Polson as Billy Bard. Brendan Gleeson as McCloy. Some interesting facts that you can fact check yourself. I'm not going to do the work for you. Of course, this film was full of drama, some mythical, some probably true. The overarching theme is Tom Cruise was stressed. He didn't get along with Wu very well. And after De Palma declined to come back, actually, Cruise wanted Wu to come back, and he liked his style. He was a hot director. But the film was delayed because Cruise was finishing Eyes Wide Shut with Stanley Kubrick. Wu didn't speak English on set. First, apparently, the first cut of the movie was 3.5 hours. So you can see that there was some tension in the movie. There was debate on stunts. You know, Tom Cruise wanted to do his stunts. Wu was like, don't do your stunts. Tom Cruise is like, I'm producing this film. And apparently, the rumor is Cruise kind of took over at the end of the film to just kind of finish it. We don't know if that's true. I don't know if you guys knew this, but Douglas Scott notoriously was unable to play Wolverine in X-Men and Bryan Singer's X-Men because of this film, because it was delayed. There's kind of speculation on what actually happened. He claimed actually in a Telegraph interview that it was Tom Cruise who stopped him to finish. I think they could have made it work with the schedule, but Cruise didn't want it. And they're shooting in Australia. So, I mean, to go from Australia, which I think X-Men was probably shot in Alberta, Canada. I don't know. Something like that. Here's this quote. Tom Cruise didn't let me do it. We were doing Mission Impossible, and then he was like, you got to stay and finish the film. And I said, I will, but I'll go and do that as well. For whatever reason, he said I couldn't. He's a very powerful guy. Other people were doing everything to make it work. So, interesting drama with the protagonist and the villain. And then Cruise's then ex-wife, or her not then wife, current ex-wife, Nicole Kidman, actually suggested Thaddeus Newton as the lead because they worked on a film called Flirting in 1991. And she's actually come out and talked about just how intense the film was. I don't think she necessarily came out in a negative way against Cruise. I think she just said he was very stressed and was, I think, what we know Tom Cruise to be now.
He's an intense guy.
Yeah, he's super intense. And he fronted more money at the end of this, didn't he? I think I remember that from something. That's just, I mean, how are you going
to afford
all that?
He was pushing to get this done. But it just seems like out of all the Mission Impossible movies, this one's production side had the most issues. All right, that's it for our facts, our team. We're ready to go. Anything before we dive into our beat-by-beat segment of Mission Impossible 2? I'm going to just take a sip.
I'm just going to call myself a woo boy just throughout podcast. Yeah. So just want to put that note in for your listeners, because
we have like, a pro
what is this
woo
guy to say?
Pro yeah, woo pro in woo. The house.
Pro woo, yeah.
Yeah, it's good to know, because you're not going to get very many pro woo sentiments from me over here. He's a fine director. Just we'll get into it. But one other fact, Luke, that you neglected to include.
Oh, did you do this while you were doing research while I was talking?
Of course for not. 10 no, minutes? I came to this podcast very prepared. So Tom Cruise is seen running on screen for a total of 36 seconds in Mission Impossible 2. Mm. This is less than the 45 seconds that we see him on screen running in Mission Impossible, the first one.
So we're down. So we're down on the running count. Okay. We're going to have to follow that trajectory.
I think we see that in the Rotten Tomatoes score. Ooh. We see that impact.
So the theory of the prestige of the film is tied to the amount of Tom Cruise running. The more he runs, the better the film.
If it were tied to the amount of time that Tom Cruise spends on motorcycles, it maybe would have had a different impact. However, it's not.
All right. Well, we got a lot to get through, guys. There's so much to talk about. Let's start out with the movie. This film, you know, it's filmed in Sydney, which is really exciting. And we know that because the first shot is the famous Sydney Opera House. And we're diving right in. I think The Matrix was filmed in Sydney or Melbourne, I believe. So late 90s action movies, Australia's hot. Tell me, as we go into the lab and we get this great character actor who plays our scientist, tell me about this whole plot, because to me this is what Hollywood people thought like a real disease was about, it was called like they, it's just funny to watch this in a post COVID world of like, this is cute. This is what they thought like diseases were. Like you could color them in like blue and red.
Oh, red is bad.
Oh, okay, red is bad. Okay. Okay.
We all know that.
Were you guys tricked by the opening sequence in the plane where the villain is actually disguised as Ethan? Were you guys tricked? Were you fooled by that?
I think you always are the first time you see it, right?
Yeah. And you're confused because Ethan's called Dimitri the entire time. And we, you know, barely know Dimitri from the previous movie. There is a name, I believe, in the first movie. The opening scene of the first movie, there's a Dimitri that someone types in. Amelia types in.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it's kind
one
of like
his pseudonyms, essentially? Yeah. One of his pseudonyms?
Or like one assumed after MI1, maybe, possibly. But yeah, you're just like, Ethan Hunt just shows up on this plane familiar with this doctor who also, by the way, he's been in other things. My personal favorite 90s movie is The Saint, and he has a big role in that. I think there's also an impersonation scene in that too.
Yeah. Yeah. The Saint, there's a lot of crossover there.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I was like, why is Ethan here? I also wasn't sure how Ethan got back fully into the fold with IMF because it was like, I'm done at the end of the first movie. So I felt like I had a lot of catch up to play in that opening
scene. It is a harsh cut from where we know Ethan was. And we get kind of a glimpse into like this is the first time we get the larger IMF, like with Anthony Hopkins being in this film, like, okay, someone's pulling the strings. We have like it's kind of there in the first one, but in this one, we really see that he doesn't fully go rogue, but he's definitely, he's working for IMF, but it's not his, he doesn't always agree with the methods. But we're jumping ahead. Let's talk about this plane sequence. I think it's a pretty good like caper. It got me, and I think Cruise does a fun job playing someone playing himself. And then they jump out of the plane, and you know, Mike, this won't land for Zach, but I was really, really surprised that Jürgen Klinsmann stepped into acting to play a henchman in this movie. Did you notice that, Mike?
I didn't pick up on that, but that's really funny. Yeah, that's really good.
Former United States men's soccer coach was playing Hugh Stamp. So quite a lookalike.
Okay.
It's very close. It's very, at least that's, I couldn't stop thinking that Jürgen Klinsmann was in this movie. We're going to jump also, to, go ahead, Zach.
Before you jump in, there's also another Ethan on the plane. So one of the minions in this movie, his name's Wallace. He's the guy that stands straight up later in the movie. He's like the techie minion.
Oh, the tech with the like, he has a little, not frosted tips, but he's got some
he does have frosted
dyed hair.
He played Ethan on Lost. If you're a Lost fan. So there's another also playing. Yeah. Yeah. He's that Ethan dude on that show.
Oh, he is.
It's not really, the face is recognizable, but it's also the way he stands up and looks at people. It's very like an exclamation point. Like he's just a walking exclamation point the entire every scene that he's in. You just see him there. He's always there, just kind of lurking. And
I know he's just there. Good catch on that. I think that's our first Lost. Lost is one of those shows where there's so many characters and actors and great character actors in the show that you have to. It's embedded throughout a lot of cinema. You know what, Zach, this might be something we need to, Mike, please take a note on this as for homework, for Mission Impossible 3. Will there be Lost character or Lost actors in Mission Impossible 3? There should be based on the director. We have to slide into, cause JJ Abrams, of course, created Lost and directed Mission Impossible 3. We got to move on to arguably one of the most iconic Mission Impossible franchise moments is Tom Cruise free climbing up a cliff. This is his vacation. And I was told by the executive producer of Least Important Things, Jay Ferris, that we had to talk about, there's an online video of famous rock climber, a free climber, Alex Honnold, talking about this scene that you can look up. I'll just drop a clip right here.
This is completely outrageous, but kind of amazing. I mean, especially looking down, you're like, oh, there are plenty of holes above him. But no, he decides to jump 15 feet sideways to a different shelf. There is a history of tower jumping sort of in climbing, but it's typically if you summit a spire and then you have to get off of it. But you would never just randomly jump from the middle of one wall to the middle of another wall for no real reason.
But what do you guys think about this scene? It's still pretty awesome. Like, Cruise looks good. Like, he looks like he knows what he's doing.
Yeah. See, the thing about this rock climbing scene is this is exactly how I envisioned Zoolander 2 starting. My vision for Zoolander 2 was that either Hansel or Derek were doing exactly this, rock climbing, free soloing, and then they get this message, and it turns out that the plot of Zoolander 2 is that after the events of Zoolander 1, the CIA recognized that male models were the premium spies they needed to train, and Derek has gone on vacation, and this is how he's getting back into it.
Just
it could be Zoolander 3, right? It could be Zoolander 3. I like it, Mike. It's a great pitch. This scene is so beautiful in so many ways. I just think it still holds up as an action sequence. Ethan Hunt. So this is what he's doing for vacation. Like, it seems like he would have be able to master something like free climbing. It would take a lot of time. So has he been practicing this his whole life, or is this like he's just doing, like, he needs to get his kicks? Like, I'm just curious.
Honnold actually makes a point about this, because Honnold talks about there's a quick like cut to his hands, and they're all like ripped up and torn apart. And Honnold says that the only reason that could be is because Cruise's characters climbing technique must be so bad, because if you have good climbing technique, you wouldn't be taking chunks out of your hand like that.
Right.
And Honnold even like showed his own hands. He's like, look, my hands don't look like this. I do this every day. Like,
so our theory in the movie is like, he's not actually good at this.
This is just, he woke up and decided to do
and
this.
And he's just a freak for adrenaline. Like, he's pushing himself to the limits. Gosh, this scene's so good. The one thing that takes away from this scene is the music is, I have no idea what's good. It's like this tribal, like Rastafarian, like I don't know what it's trying to tell us. Like, I guess that he's on vacation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really work in the second half of the scene. First scene, it's like, okay, this is vacation-y, but then when he like pushes himself, yeah, you know, he opens up himself, like, hey, out from the rock, and then the music just like amplifies. You're like, no, I can't do this part.
And we're just like, da, 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 da. It's like, hey, we're having a fun time, yeah, here. Like, our hero's, yeah, like about to die.
As this song was playing over, I had a thought to myself that this actually shouldn't be a scene in a movie. But this should just have been an Apple iPod shuffle commercial with, yes, the white cord hanging off of Tom Cruise. And so I felt like this actually became a really missed opportunity for Apple Co. for product placement.
It's interesting, Mike. I think that's brilliant, because it's just added to the movie. It's this sequence took a long time to film. It was a huge delay in production just to get this done. So, and it doesn't really add anything to the plot at all. So they might as well should have like gotten Apple involved and made.
The earbuds white cord hanging,
yeah,
just like going off. That was just perfect.
I think you could do a re-edit, right? And make it happen.
I think we should.
This music is so terrible. It's so bad.
Do you have it?
No, because I wrote down music and I was like, I have to remember what the music was, and then I just put the volume up.
That song is like a TikTok trend these days.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is.
Oh boy. Ethan Hunt, TikTok trendsetter, ahead of his time. Yeah. We have the glasses reveal, which is, I think it's pretty good. He throws them and it explodes.
I think every high school boy in America was really proud to own a pair of those. Oakleys.
Yeah, it's so of the time, the Oakleys.
I just love when the guy launches it from the helicopter, he like calls his shot. That's the best part to me. It's just, it's going there, not at you. It's going in this rock right here.
Maybe there. I got it, guys.
Because as the viewer, you're thinking, like, when you see a helicopter come up out of nowhere, this must be a bad guy. This is an assassination attempt on Ethan Hunt. Yeah.
But it's not.
Exactly. Ethan's just cool.
Then we get our title sequence, lots of red, a fire, the symbolism of the two Greek or the Greek mythos, which they really, really like talking about. And then our Mission Impossible title sequence that shatters. Wow. Very, very 90s. And then we get our introduction into our, I don't know, femme fatale, but our leading lady, Thad Newton, who's an amazing actress. Sorry.
You just called her Thad? I've never heard that, and I love it forever.
I don't know if that's her nickname, but I feel like it is. She's, of course, a lot of people know her from the HBO show.
Westworld.
Thank you, Zach. She's amazing in this movie. I really liked her as a character. Typical 90s action movies, her role as a woman is definitely, they try to set her up as being like, she's a thief, she's a master thief, and then like she's basically turns into a damsel in distress at the end. It's one of those things where they're trying as an action movie to like, but it's like, oh, these are men writing a female character, and then they kind of like forget about her, the ways in. But the whole idea is that Ethan's supposed to get her. He thinks he's supposed to get her on the team as a master thief. Guys,
she's also, sorry.
Go ahead.
Thand, as we now know her, is also in Solo.
Yes. Yeah. She's in a lot of good stuff.
Amazing stuff.
The dancing. Tell me about the whole. This felt like a Roger Moore James Bond movie where they're like, we're on a location, people are dancing. Like, why? What does that help us? There's no reason to have the dancing to me.
I think they want to immediately do like a meet cute thing because. Yeah. I think that's a big note from the first one is there's not a whole lot of romance. And then they're immediately going to just put it out there like salsa music in front of you, slow motion shots as they look into each other's eyes from across the room.
Yeah.
I think they're just trying to call their shot and probably a little just like that guy on the helicopter and probably a little bit too explicitly. This is when I started making my slow motion scenes list. That's where it started. Yeah.
That's the first one. It is a course correct from the first film. As we know, the first film, there was supposed to be a love triangle, but it was essentially cut out. You could see, and we talked about it in our first episode, but they're going on totally the opposite end. They're like, this love story is the key driver to this entire movie.
Yeah. I mean, and they just do some, I do like this scene actually a lot just from a technical end, but that's just the movie person and me being like, oh, cool scene matching. As she's like about to leave, as she's like trying to do the robbery itself, there's some cool like hand movements that also match with some stuff that, you know, Ethan's doing or the dancers are doing. It is a fun style.
It's like it's just so different than the first movie. Like the first movie like kind of pulls the carpet under us and we're like, oh my gosh, this is getting pretty dark. Whereas this is like, this is gonna be a fun film because they're in the bathtub and having a lot of sexual tension. This is where I was like, this literally, if you put Roger Moore in a 1970, like, this is exactly like a Roger Moore Bond, just the innuendos, like the whole setup is so Bond to me. It just feels very of that era. It just was a shock compared to the first one, but they're having fun, aren't they?
Yeah, it doesn't do it for me. It's a very contrived romance. And not only that, the slow-mo shots are killing me. And they just get worse and worse as we go through the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, even at the end of that scene, like after, you know, everything's dissolved, Ethan's like, I've bamboozled you, and she gets in her car. They just slow down the end of that scene for like 2 extra seconds, and you're like, this is just going to be the trope, isn't it? Just hit half speed whenever
it's very slow here. It's very slow here. And then the car chase, which I don't know. I feel like you could have either cut the car chase or cut the opening caper, that you didn't need both of them. I guess they're trying to build the romance, but that I actually like the car chase. I thought that was fun. I like the spinning. I like that they're convertibles. And there's a lot of hair whipping with Cruise's long hair, slow motion of them staring to each other's eyes as they spin.
Those cars they're such an early 2000s like design too. Like
I like it. I like it though.
I hated that era of vehicle. But and just the that Porsche belongs in a different class than that Audi in terms of like it's like street cred. Like there's no way that Audi is keeping up with that Porsche.
Really? Aren't they made by the same people?
They are. It's product placement by Volkswagen.
Oh, because they own both, right? At that time, did they own both still? They must have, right? If they had them both in the movie,
I mean, they must. I guess.
Come on, Mike. You're a car correspondent. You got to have.
Companies change hands all the time. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, Audi's a great Audi. There's a lot of fast Audis, but like that Porsche is going to outpace that Audi.
Easily. Yeah, but Ethan Hunt. Was Ethan really in the Audi or was he in the Porsche?
He was in the Porsche.
Okay. Go ahead, Zach.
Is that the street car kind? Is the Audi then versus the Porsche? Also a guy who doesn't know cars that well. Do you think it's representative of maybe their personalities a little bit? Just like maybe some other vehicles later down the road, but we'll get to that.
Maybe. That Audi tends in my, this is my per, wow. Okay. This is going out on a limb here, but so anyway, welcome back to our car podcast.
How many years ago did car talk about there? Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike. I'm sorry. I'm interested.
I was just going to say to Zach's point, that Audi from the design lines of it. I'm a guy who really pays attention to the lines on a car, and that's how they design cars in a 2D perspective. But the lines in that car almost have like an effeminate quality to it.
Okay.
And Porsches are like very traditionally very masculine vehicles. Not like your American Muscle necessarily, but definitely your elite European power kind of thing.
Gotcha. Thank you. And that's been Car Talk with Mike. Sponsored by Volkswagen. We know drama.
I mean, it does kind of set the tone because we just talked about like Nia, right? That's her name, Naya. I don't know if it's a hard Y or a soft Y. It's just Naya, yep. There's definitely gender roles in here that we're going to hold on to throughout this movie. So I think it is interesting. Even this irresponsible dance that they do that results in something really bad. Like most superhero secret agent action types, it doesn't end like that. And somehow, like, she could have died. She probably should have died if not for plot, you know, magic.
IMFHR would not be happy with this report. I don't think IMFHR exists because Ethan sleeps with the first person he recruits to his team. Not a good look. I have in my notes.
He was instructed to recruit her too.
Yeah. Not good. I have in my notes, creepy hands and damn, you're beautiful. yeah. I think Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise playing Ethan Hunt is talking about himself, not about, Naya, not about Naya. He's not talking about Naya. He's talking about himself when he says, damn, you're beautiful. I just thought that was extra creepy and fun. Moving on from that.
it's just Andy Newton, but her face is a mirror in that scene, actually.
That's probably how they played it. That's probably how she was not in that scene at all. Tony Hopkins in this movie, I kind of feel bad for him.
Why is he here?
I think I read that he was not first choice. It was he kind of came in right at the end.
Oh, yeah. Ian McKellen was supposed to be in it first, I think.
Right. And Ian, guess what, was doing Lord of the Rings and then X-Men. So another X-Men connection. Really, cool. X-Men could have had a whole different history in Mission Impossible 2. Their histories are intertwined. Could have been both very different films. But I kind of feel bad about Tony Hopkins being in this movie. He brings too much gravitas. It's like too much for this film.
And Ethan and I can't remember his actual name in the movie, but between Tom Cruise and the two, like, they can't share the same room together or same scene. It's like, it's really hard, a big push and pull, like you said. Like, Tom Cruise just wants to climb rocks, you know, defy gravity, and Anthony Hopkins is trying to keep everybody down. So
he's like acting. He's bringing so much to the role that, like, you could, there's, and I guess maybe that's a good thing about the movie, is like there's almost a sinisterness to his character as the IMF leader. But I'm curious to compare this is really first time we see like head honcho IMF leader come in and give Ethan orders. We haven't really seen that yet, but that will continue as a trope throughout the franchise.
And he gives the best line that he could have done in this movie. Do you guys, can I read it? Is it okay?
Yes, please.
Okay. He says, it's not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible.
You know what? The writers love that one. That's a Star Trek line, baby. That's a TNG line right there. That's a Patrick Stewart. That's someone who wrote for Patrick Stewart for 10 years. That's all I got to say, baby. He's like, oh, I got Tony Hopkins. He's saying this line, and we're going to have a lot of fun. So we get the team together. It is Luther comes back. And then we have a local Aussie, Billy Baird, who flies the helicopter.
Yeah.
Is that kind of, he's kind there. of the grease man, kind of?
Yeah, he's just a pilot. Yeah, he's just there to make sure that we know that we're going to be in Australia the rest of the movie.
Yes.
And that there's going to be flying. I don't know.
Yes. And so the whole mission is get Naya to get back together with her ex-boyfriend, who is Sean. And Sean has... Does he have the antidote or does he have the virus? He has the virus.
Yes. No, he has the antidote.
I thought he had the virus.
It's very hard to tell.
Yeah, he has the antidote. He needs the virus, but we don't even at this point know that because it's so convoluted. Like,
it's
you don't
so convoluted.
Know. Yeah.
The IMF rented a farm in the bush as their headquarters. I think that was an extra, like, we're in Australia. I do have to say the Sean's house. I was like, so he's obviously wants to get money. He's a former IMF agent, or he's a hired mercenary. Because we know that Tony Hopkins told us, like, he was brought in. He's a consultant.
He's a double for.
Yeah, but like, he has this house. Is he renting it? Because I'm like, do you need more money if you have that house? Like, it's incredible. It's gorgeous. It's on the Sydney Bay.
It's possible. This is a stretch, but it's possible that the CEO of the pharmaceutical company, that house is owned by him. And that Isdine uses a safe house in the interim, before they complete their business deal. There's
that actually makes a lot more sense.
Absolutely nothing, but that's just a theory.
Interesting. That makes a lot. It almost feels like you said, Mike, there could be somebody, a bigger baddie pulling the strings, like Thanos is somewhere pulling the strings. Cause he doesn't feel like Sean is, he's fine. I liked him as a villain. I think it almost was like, there wasn't enough, I guess Naya's the tension, but there wasn't enough like hatred between, like, I didn't understand like why he was angry at Hunt. Like, I guess cause he was thwarting his mission, but I think it would have been better if like he had more, we've learned more backstory about him and Hunt, but I digress. Go ahead, Zach.
I think he wants to be Ethan.
Oh, that's kind of okay.
So this is kind of like an overarching thing that I saw in this movie is there's just kind of like this duality between the two of them, even like with our, as we get into it, our face-offs that we will have later in this movie, and even at the beginning. So he can do Ethan really well, but I don't know if he chose the right path, that perhaps maybe he was given something similar to how Ethan was given a choice in Mission Impossible and probably took the wrong path. That's kind of where I see it. I think there's a lot of those themes in this movie is like duality. Yeah, so I think that's kind of it.
Would you say this is Mission Impossible 2 Face Off 2?
It's Face Off. Yeah, it's Face Off. There's just no waterfalls in this movie. It is there's no waterfalls in this. It is just a bunch of just literal masks being taken off and put back on. So yeah. But yeah, I think you're gonna see that a lot in this movie if you do watch it. Like there's some. It's hard. It's hard, but it's really buried. But that's
why there. I'm a Wu fan here. There's a lot, and that there's a lot there. What did you guys think about Hugh Stamp? There's a scene where Hugh is very skeptical of Naya and like thinks that she's bad business. It is like there is some. It's so romantic. Like the sexual tension between those two is so palpable in that scene. Like he's so jealous of her that she's there. It's like a very homoerotic scene. And like, I'm like, did they intend to like, it was so obvious to me that I'm like, was that intentional or was it just how they like the actors wanted to play it? I mean, I was like, I want to know that storyline. That's the love triangle.
I think you're thinking way too much about it. His over the top acting on that is more to do with the fact that the movie itself is so outrageous.
I don't know.
I saw it, Luke. Yeah.
Thank you. I think there's an entire different plot line on the other side of this movie.
Yeah. That's the other love triangle. It's the subplot love triangle here.
I think that's there. I think they missed an opportunity. That was going to be an entire another plot. Let's go to the horse tracks. I actually like the scene as like a spy. Wait, but
before we go to the horse tracks, I'm sorry. There's something that happens here that I feel like we really need to comment on.
Okay.
So we learn that there's photographic or video evidence of, I don't know, something, and that it's on a memory card. And this memory card becomes very important.
Okay? I loved it.
You get a little view of the size of the memory card. It's a 32 megabyte memory card.
Yeah.
So in the first movie, we had the floppy disks.
Yes.
And just so that we're all clear, right? Floppy disks had 1.4 megabytes on them. Okay. And that floppy disk contained, I even forget
the list. The knock list.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So basically an Excel spreadsheet. And I think this is funny. So we went from 1.4 to 32 megabytes in real time. Okay. That reflects what was.
Yeah. Within the three or four years.
Within the 3 year period. That's a 95% increase of memory capacity in 3 years.
The technology's moving fast. That's why you gotta love these action movies, because they are always ahead of the game when it comes to capacity, storage, RAM storage, megabytes, and transferring files.
Yes. Yeah. And I just want our audience to know we're gonna keep tabs on this. We recognize this is something that our constituency cares about. We are with this. We are gonna fight this fight with you. We are keeping track. Yes. Yes. The memory sizes.
Podcast Impossible is all about the through lines. And the most important through lines of this franchise is storage capacity of vital information that can help Ethan Hunt save the day. And that's why we're here, folks. Sponsored by Kodak.
Kodak, yes.
When we start hitting cloud storage, I'm really excited for you guys. Like, what's going to happen there? It's going to be incredible.
A lot of calculations. Now, Zach, you've used memory cards before. You're a man that, you're in videography, in content creation. You've handled your fair share of memory cards. Why wouldn't they make multiple backups of these important files? What was your take on the strategy as a memory card professional? What did you think about the strategy?
Are you talking about from Ambrose's side? Is it just one memory card? I really don't know. I really don't know how they fit that whole memory.
Sorry, let me jump in here, Zach, and help you out. It's because
the whole mini doc.
The reason why is, remember, it's 32 megabytes. Okay, that's massive. Okay,
yeah,
do you know
it's
how
true.
Expensive 32 megabytes is? Ambrose doesn't have that kind of money. He's holed up in some safe house. It's not even his. He's got no money. He can afford a 32 megabyte another one once he gets his $37 million. He needs that money in order to get a second
memory card. He's like, can't make that Radio Shack run.
Can I add to this mythos that we're creating that Ambrose is dirt poor?
Yes.
In real life, the actual house on that island that Ambrose is staying in was made out of styrofoam. The entire thing was made out of styrofoam, and they bulldozed it after the fact. They bulldozed it after the scene was done and moved on with their lives. Ambrose is literally in a styrofoam house this entire movie, that entire set of scenes.
I love that.
That is amazing.
I love that Ambrose is not just bankrupt morally, but bankrupt actually.
Yes, yes. And you know, money doesn't cure everything, as we find out. I do have to say, to continue to put a wrap on the memory cards, not to talk about memory cards. Welcome to podcast memory cards. I will give him credit. He does have a case for the memory card. And he puts the case with the memory card in an envelope. So double protection, envelope, memory card in the case. They're in Australia. There's a lot of sand. They're at a racetrack. You never know. You never know.
It's an encrypted envelope, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know if it was encrypted.
It's thief-proof, actually.
Do you think in that envelope, because you know how sometimes when you have an envelope, but you're not willing to seal it yet.
Yeah.
Right? So you don't lick it. You don't.
Lick or non-lick, yeah. Yeah.
Are you the type of person that takes the fold of the envelope and folds it into the envelope so that it's not
Oh, no, I hate that. I hate that. My mom used to do that all the time. Put the slides. Yeah. Does he do it? Let me check, guys. Does he fold it in? Let me get the tape. This is very important. At the racetrack, they're looking at the cameras. We see him. It cuts to Luther. He puts it in. Oh, we don't see it.
No fold.
They cut. Okay. We don't know. I don't know if he folded it in.
I'm also kind of disappointed. It's just like a plain envelope. It's not even like a business security envelope.
No. It's sloppy. Hey, he's got to cut costs somehow. He's got to cut costs. Well, the problem is he spent everything on the masks. Think about the cost of the masks. He does 2-3 mask reveals. That's Blue's budget right there. And he put money down on the horses. I mean, I think he's got a problem. He's got a gambling problem. He's in dire straits.
That's why he's poor. Is because he's gambled everything on the horses. Yes.
Yeah.
It's tough.
I think the IMF actually, that's a severance package, is you get 3 Ethan Hunt masks.
Yes.
Have fun. No money from us. Have a good day. Never
have a good
come
day.
Back.
Barter system.
Yeah.
So we're on the racetracks. Great little caper scene. The whole idea is that she's trying to... Guys, it's the movie. She's trying to steal the memory card so Luther can make a copy of the memory card. I love this. This was a great scene. It's really, really fun. Yeah, the IMF budget's way better. Because Luther has he has the full setup. I mean, he's ready to go. It's a great fun little scene. I feel like Billy does his only useful thing is to stop Hugh, and that's besides flying the helicopter. That was kind of his one deal.
Such a Mr. Bean moment for Billy.
I know. It was good. And then they were able to get and copy what was on the SD card.
I don't know that upload. That just via satellite. The upload
was quick. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite a thorough. I think that was above a 32 megabyte file because it was like a full motion presentation with video and graphics.
Oh yeah.
I don't know.
It was compressed though. It was a zip file.
I'm sure Luther he knew what he was doing. He's like, it's a zip file. Drag it.
In the 3-hour cut, James Earl Jones's voice is underneath the entire thing too, just narrating.
She's able to like make the switch back. This is really her only time we actually see her like being a thief. So does he know that she stole it? Is that what?
Yeah.
What we learned with the pockets.
Yeah, the next one, because he explicitly says, I think with, what's his name?
Hugh.
Man that he's passionately in love with.
Yes, it's in my right pocket.
It's in my right darling. Pocket, yeah. Yeah. But he had already caught it. Like, there was a moment where he caught the slip. She's not as good as
I know. They really do her dirty.
Yeah, they do.
My next note isn't until he's in the lab. So,
yeah, we got the pharma stuff.
So but we got some. Do we have any time? There's nothing that happens between the racetrack and pharmacy. Well,
there's kind of a pharmacy. We go to the pharmacy. We go to Walgreens. We pick up our other SD card and develop our photos. There's a double switch. So our IMF team captures. Brendan Gleeson as McCoy, who's the pharmaceutical guy. He owns the pharmaceutical company. He wants to have this disease go out in the world because he has the cure so they can make money. Right? That's his whole plot is.
He figured that because the doctor like developed the most deadly disease in the world, that the antidote for that disease would be worth a fortune. Gotcha. So his plan was like, if I can get the disease out, then I can make money on the antidote.
Yes, because he says the antidote we can replicate and no problem. He says that later in the movie, and we're like, I don't think you can just automatically replicate enough antidote to make money. We know that as people in 2023. But there's a double switch. So Ethan pretends to be the doctor and gets the information. But at the same time, Sean is pretending to be Ethan to get Naya to basically know Naya's working with Ethan. But it's a nice interstitch cut. I thought it was really good. Classic Mission Impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was really impressed. Actually, like, evil Ethan is really cool. I really like that. And he actually – there's something that this Ambrose's eyes that kind of, like, also Cruz is able to kind of bring in his face when they're against the wall like that talking. I was really impressed with that. That's really cool. To see a little bit of a different side of Tom Cruise, too, like, in one movie. Yeah. You don't get to
it was fun. It was fun that way. So that's kind of sets up our second to final mission, which is we got to get into the medical in the lab in the pharmacy. We got to get into the pharmacy. Luther and Ethan are doing it. This is a great edit. This is like this is 90s action at the best. So essentially how they set it up is Sean is describing how Ethan's going to get into the building. He knows exactly how he's going to get into the building. This really reminds me of National Treasure. I'm getting a lot of National Treasure vibes where you have the two different people. It's the caper, the double caper. So you have the bad guys going in like Lock, Stock and Smoking Barrel, just like we're going to walk in the front door and just essentially just plow through everybody. And then you have the good guys doing a more complex acrobatic stunt. Ethan basically jumps from the helicopter and goes through the air conditioning vents, which on the list of Mission Impossible stunts, this is probably the least impressive, right? Because it's mainly CGI.
Yeah, is it even a stunt?
It's a stunt because we do see him like going down the shaft, but it's pretty much CGI. And then they do a callback to the first Mission Impossible because he lands, he like stops right before the bottom. Mm-hmm. But it's fine. It was just, I was like, well, that's probably one of the worst quote unquote stunts or action sequences.
Yeah, I guess it takes it away from it being a stunt because there's no sense of realism to it, in my opinion.
Outside of Luther just counting down, which is like, give me some Ving Rhames counting down a clock. I mean, that dude knows how to do it.
And then you watch him count down a clock later.
Yeah, it's like, it's just, it's just amazing. So basically Ethan gets in, and then the bad guys come and it's a kind of a shoot 'em up. Luther loses track. It's pretty fun. This is what I remember the most from, like, I feel like this scene was always on TV when I like tuned in this movie, like this scene in the lab with the shootout. I really like that. They go after Luther in the van and Luther gets out, but is like smart enough to get the laptop, because it has apparently has her location. It's the only laptop that has her GPS location. There's no other way.
The thing I noticed here, so we talked at the beginning like how Ethan Hunt on his vacation just decided one day to wake up and free solo this crazy Utah cliff.
Yeah.
And so I mean, it makes sense to me that all of a sudden he's also just a molecular biologist. Like he's just he is a molecular biologist. He's going around. He knows how to use the equipment.
Yes, he's like he's very familiar. Very, very familiar with the equipment.
He's like destroying samples in vitro, and he's okay, this is the temperature.
I know exactly what to do. I got this down. He was doing that like on the plane. He studied it. That's why it's very Bond to me. Like this is, it's a very Bond formula where like, oh, he just knows everything. The interesting thing about this shootout sequence is like Sean like walks in and there's these interesting shots of him just like looking over his team, like go, like it's kind of funny. Like it reminds me of James Bond where like the villain's not actually doing the work. He's got a bunch of henchmen. And it also had a little bit of a Matrix vibe to it with the slow-mo. It's just that era in the leather.
Yeah.
And the flipping.
When he slides and across and yeah, just kind of shoots some feet. That was a hardcore Neo move, I think.
Yeah. And just like semi-automatic weapons and just like the wall squibs, glass. It's so 90s action.
Yeah. The dexterity that just one individual, Tom Cruise, shows in his like ability to maintain focus and aim and like all these ridiculous roles and everything that is going on. It's just, it is so like, it takes me out of it every time I see it. Like I can suspend disbelief for a minute when I'm watching a movie, but it's just so hard with these scenes for me.
It's a little bit like, it's almost, this isn't what we know of Ethan Hunt in the rest of the franchise. Like it just doesn't really remind me much of Ethan Hunt. Like Ethan Hunt is a lot more, he's more of a Indiana Jones-esque where he is good at thinking on his feet. Like he messes up a lot and he's just really good at improvising and using his space. Like a real spy, you know, you'd think a real spy would be. This is very, again, it's a 90s action movie. We can't get out of the era that we're in. It's cemented. But basically what happens is Naya stabs herself with the disease, right? Not the cure,
yeah.
The disease.
Right, right.
And sacrifices herself because she loves Ethan.
Yeah. I mean, if you can't, if no one else wanted to do it, like there was one option on that floor, like someone was going to inject it, right? Why not?
Yeah.
Why not just our object that we're treating, you know, this entire, she's just an object. She's just,
she's literally an object. By.
Yeah.
Now she's just, essentially a vial that has the disease in it. It's a cool idea. Like I actually think as a character for Naya, she reads the situation well. So I think it's actually a smart move from a, like if you're in the world of the movie, like that will, that actually helps the team, the good guys. But from a writing standpoint, you're like, okay, we're done with her. Now she's just, basically has the disease and is an object.
And she's even just like, she's the tracking device so that they get a little bit of a heads up from the eyes in the sky that Ambrose is showing up early, but it doesn't matter because Ethan doesn't have comms. So why is she there from a plot perspective at all? Like, it doesn't make sense. We're just going to write her in for the scene in a way.
Yeah, because why would he? I guess he assumed if he brought her, it would be a bargaining chip.
Maybe. He said Ethan. He was going to kill her. He said he was going to kill her explicitly. So, yeah, it was, I don't know. It sucks. I wish she was had a better.
So, movie. Ethan does like, Last of the Mohicans. I think it's almost word for word. Mm-hmm. Stay alive. Like that's Last Mohicans. He says, stay alive. I will find, it's essentially the same line. Another great 90s action movie directed by Michael Mann. So she has 20 hours until
there's no turning back.
There's no turning back. She's,
yeah, because she's gonna die. Like, I think like 37 hours afterwards is like death.
Yeah.
But within 20 hours, you could administer the antidote.
Right, right. So,
which can we, I've just been thinking about this, right? So, if the idea was for the baddies, let's get this disease out there, and I will make money from the antidote. Wouldn't it raise like a million red flags to be like, oh, there's this disease. Guess what? Got it right here, guys. Antidote. Check it out.
We knew. Already,
yeah, like
we knew.
So how does it? Ready. You could follow it. The trace of it would be pretty easy. It was like your employee created the disease.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. This is me, John Wooing or Woo Manning again. But I think that I think Bellerophon was supposed to be actually be like a little bit more of a catch-all kind of vaccine. So it was kind of like. Chimera was, I literally, it's like Harvey Dent. Okay. It's Harvey Dent. Sometimes you have to, in order to, have something amazing, you also have to have the opposite of it. You have to have the villain. So they had to kind of write that in there. It's my duality thesis that I'm writing on the side for this movie that I won't add too much into this podcast because we're having a shit ton of fun with Ambrose being poor instead.
We got to get back. We have an automotive podcast that we're going to get back to.
Yes, we do. We have an SD Card Weekly, our other podcast that we're starting because of this film. So our final caper, our final mission is basically there's a bunker where they're doing the deal that the pharmaceutical company owns that they're going to do a deal. Really cool location. Really fun. We have Ethan rock climbing a much smaller rock wall, but very slippery. So the high degree of difficulty. So I got to give him that. And this is a fun scene. I feel like the tension of like Brendan Gleeson as the pharmaceutical guy, like sweating it out. They're testing it. Like this is fun. It's like kind of like a white collar drug deal. And then kind of Ethan starts getting after it. Gentlemen, let's talk about birds. Why birds? Why have them in the film? Especially if you've already used them in your film as a director. I understand like why not? Like that's also the inverse of this. But what are your thoughts on these were pigeons or doves? The first, because there's
first group pigeons.
I remember I'm like, oh, this is this shot. There's one shot where he's running, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not. The first shot are pigeons, right? When he's going through the tunnel.
When he's going through the tunnel, he's trying to take out all the, you know, all the guards, which are just standing there, and it's really easy, and he's actually doing something on the side the entire time. That's all pigeons.
Okay. Which is like kind of believable. It's like you're in the building. I guess they could get down there. That's fun. Yeah.
And he does that amazing back bicycle kick flip with the pigeons.
That was fun. That was pretty fun. Cool. That was good.
Yeah. But that's just that's a child bird. Like, that's just your typical run-of-the-mill bird. These are typical run-of-the-mill, you know, cloak and dagger things that he's doing right now. So I think that's what they're trying to signify there.
So, and then the second time we see them, it's when he's going through the door. Okay, I'm trying to pull it up here so I can just make sure I'm accurately describing it.
Yeah. Then they become doves.
Yes. Yeah, so he throws the explosive.
They're like Pokemon. They've evolved.
Yes. The doors are burning. You see the flames in Sean's eyes. I mean, and the white dove comes through. Then we see Ethan walking by.
Mm-hmm. Come get
in
me.
In red.
That's what he's saying.
Come get me, baby. I mean, I don't know if it's a jump the shark moment, but it's like it is a statement. And Ethan Hunt is making a statement. What do you think the dove symbolizes, though? Let's get 12th grade English on this.
Sometimes they're just doves. there's a great book I was forced to read in high school. It's called How to Read Literature Like a Professor. And
did you read that, or did you spark note it?
I did read it. And it's all of these, like, it's basically teaching you, like, when an author does this is what they're trying to do, or this is what it means sometimes. And it's all these chapters on how to pick up things that authors are doing in their books. And one chapter is titled "Sometimes It's Just Raining," and the whole chapter is just describing that oftentimes authors will use rain to signify cleansing or sadness or new birth or
catharsis. You know,
something. And then catharsis.
That's a good one.
And then it just goes, sometimes it's just raining. Sometimes the rain doesn't mean anything. So in my opinion, sometimes it's just birds.
I think the dove symbolizes the purity of Ethan, like Zach said, the duality, the purity of Ethan versus the evilness of Sean. And it's interesting because we see and then it comes back actually when he's hanging, the dove. So the dove follows him, and Ethan like looks at the dove, kind of like annoyed, but also, I respect you because I'm also a dove for the world.
You know what? I think I agree with all these. I think there's other reasons why we might want to look into the doves further. But for just this podcast, I think that the pigeons is what Ambrose could afford. And the dove is what Ethan brought as kind of like, that's his, like, there's not a lot of gadgets in this movie. I think that's his gadget for this movie is the dove.
His dove. It's a mechanical dove, or it's like an IMF dove. It was a
bird potluck, and they each brought birds because they commiserate to what they could afford.
BYO bird. Yep.
Obviously, the dove was much better because Ethan takes down Hugh pretty intense fashion, and then we get another mask switch, which I think that was mask number five in my count. I did have in my notes at one point, stop doves, stop. So that I think there was enough of that. So basically, shit's hit the fan. Ethan is on the run from the facility. He has the anecdote, and he's got to get to Naya, who is looking to jump off a cliff.
And I love that the cars. So like, he's on a motorcycle, right?
Go before ahead, we do motorcycles, Zach. One more. Ambrose is poor. So he is, he's like, yes, here to Brendan Gleeson, like, here is these things. You will give us the money. Also,
yeah, the stock options.
Give us stock options. I need to I need a portfolio for the future.
He doesn't want the cash. He's like, I want the stock options. And I'm also like, you want to run a corporation during a pandemic? That's your plan? That's literally his plan, is like, I'm going to take over your company and then run. It'd be like, it would be like somewhere like, you know what? I want to run Pfizer in 2020. That is my dream. I've been a mercenary and a soldier and an IMF agent. I'm ready to get into high level pharmaceutical corporations
and executive.
Give me that C-suite, executive C-suite. I want to get in it. Hostile takeover.
Ambrose being poor, I have another one. So Cruz is on his motorcycle, cruising away, and chasing him are none other than Ford escorts.
Yes.
just a fleet of Ford escorts.
Wow. Oh my gosh. They're like, oh, we can only afford like suburban sales dad cars. So
as our henchman cars. They like couldn't afford to buy cars for the mission, so everyone had to just use their car.
Like, I still have this from college. It's right. Barely working, but it gets the job done.
He promised me he got stock options. He'd reimburse me for gas. Yeah.
But you better submit that to the finance. You got that expense report done. man, I love the motorcycles. I love Cruise on a motorcycle. It's really cool. It's the one thing that is shocking, though, is you cut from Cruise. So they do these nice wide shots of him with his billowing hair. And then you cut to Dougray Scott, who is obviously being pulled by a car on the motorcycle, because you have only tight shots of him on a motorcycle. And he's kind of doing like the motorcycle game that you do at the arcade, like it's like he's not really doing that. Whereas Cruz is obviously cruising on and having a blast. Lots of explosions, lots of flips.
Yeah, apparently cars in this movie, just when they hit anything, just spontaneously combust.
It's just, they go. Not a great product by Ford.
Some Ford exploders out there.
That's great. It's so good.
They should have just been all Ford Pintos. That just like literally, like they hit a tree and they just like collapse.
That actually, the car that Ethan almost slides into and cuts off his head, that was a Ford Pinto.
Are you serious?
No. Keep it in.
One of my favorite parts of the chase is Ethan is talking to Luther and he said, like, track me, my earbud's not working. I thought that was like, it didn't need to be in the movie, but it felt really realistic where he's like,
yeah,
my earbud's not working. I'm like, yeah, it wouldn't work if you're riding without a helmet, like going 100 miles on a Ducati bike, like, and someone's in a helicopter. Like, it wouldn't work. I just thought it was a nice touch, like, of realism in a movie that we just saw doves billowing about three minutes ago. It's very, very nice.
And then juxtapose that with, like, less than a minute later, Ethan is ice skating on the road next to a motorcycle.
I loved it. If you're going to have fun, I mean, I think that is actually physically possible. Maybe not at those speeds.
Maybe.
But I thought it was fun. Like,
if he had Heelys on, you know he's running around there with Heelys.
That was the moment where he needed them. IMF, that was the one thing they couldn't get in the budget. Like, and he's like, and Heelys. I need that a part of my tactical gear. Well, really? Heelys? It's a must. Sorry.
Yeah, Rose won't see this coming. He can't afford these. My next note was just, I wanted to talk about the jousting that they were doing at the end. We can get to that if we want to go backwards.
No, we could go to the jousting, the medieval times jousting. Motorcycle jousting, I don't know. I think it's great. Somebody in a meeting pitched that, and it was like a face-off of jousting. I don't know. I think it's fun. But it's pretty incredible.
I liked it. I thought it was funny.
Like, I don't know whose idea it was. So like, and then they meet in the middle of the air.
Yeah, his bike too was like absolutely impenetrable through like most of that scene, and then just suddenly, I think it was right after he just sidecars it, he just gets one little hole in that fuel tank, and that just.
Yep.
We're supposed to know about that. This is going to happen. We're going to give cause to why this is going to explode this time.
This time we're actually going to tell you why it exploded. We're going to give justification for the explosion.
It's justification for every other explosion. We must now assume that all the other vehicles had leaky fuel tanks, probably because they couldn't get enough like repair jobs done on time because Ambrose was broke.
Their mechanic is bad. They're giving them bad deals, I think.
Bad deals.
But so I mean, you can have an entire fleet of Fords.
So every really time hard. Ambrose takes his fleet in to be repaired, he always asks, but is it necessary to do this now?
Do I have to do this? Be straight with me. Be straight with me. How long can I ride this out? How long can I ride it out?
How many miles do I got on this?
If this was your henchman's car, would you let him continue to drive it? Be honest. Be real with me. So we have the sand fight, which I actually think this is a great fight sequence. I think it's really raw and intense. This reminds me of like a lot of the fights that we'll see throughout the franchise. Really, really just raw, intense.
Zach,
emotion.
You're shaking your head. You don't like this scene?
I don't know about that, Luke. I don't know about that.
You don't like a sand fight?
So in theory, yes. But I don't think it's a fair fight. I think Ambrose knows nothing about martial arts.
It's pretty obvious. Ethan should have beat him much faster. Like, it's kind of embarrassing for Ethan.
Ethan's got all the right moves, right? But then Ambrose just kind of just stands there for it at least three times in that fight. Like, man, that guy can take a hit because he's not even trying. There's no dodge. He just stands there.
That's true.
It's like one of his henchmen just like standing up like an exclamation mark and then boom, like just gets nailed in the face at least three times in a row in that scene.
Ethan does like a flying, like a flying side kick where he like kicks the back of Ambrose's head. Like, and I just wonder, what is the risk reward of that move in the moment? It doesn't seem like it does a lot,
but it feels cool. And that's the most important thing.
I mean, it was in slow motion and there was sand flying in the air. I mean, it was cool.
I think that's where you get more like the style over the actual fighting is. But I think, Zach, you do bring up a good point. And maybe it kind of makes me think, like, no against to Doug Ray Scott. Like, he might be a good fighter, like might be an athletic guy, but it doesn't really feel like it. And I'm really glad he didn't play Wolverine because he doesn't do a lot. And maybe that was by design. Like, they want Ethan to look cool. And they're putting up just kind of a blank canvas against him, but he does like to jaw with Ethan, which I think that's kind of his skill set, is to like mentally go after him.
We're just trying to get to one spot in that fight anyways, and that's the knife scene.
In the knife, he slashes him, and then
fun fact, I also read some trivia. That is a real scene where Tom Cruise was like, no, you're going to have this a half inch from my eye and you're going
really?
To. Yeah. They put it on a tensioned wire and then they had Doug Ray Scott or whatever actually on top of that knife. And that's a practical shot actually.
Wow.
So he was like, hey, dude, lean on this knife. It's got tension, but it's literally John Woo was like, no, it can just miss. It can just like go to the side of your face.
Yeah.
Probably that time you get cut. But literally, that was a Tom Cruise specific shot that he really wanted in the movie.
Is that, and I'm being honest here, is that the literal closest that Ethan Hunt has ever come to death?
Well, it's a callback to the first movie where the helicopter blade, remember how close the helicopter blade at the end of the scene goes really close to his neck? So I think that's what I saw when I saw that. I was like, oh, this is a callback. That has to be pretty close. I feel like the helicopter jump and blade was more of like, I didn't think Ethan thought he was going to make it in the first one.
Yeah.
Cause he jumps on the helicopter. At that point, he's got to be like, I'm probably not going to make it out of this. Where I think in this fight, he still has the upper hand. But yeah, it is another close call for Ethan of many close calls that we'll probably see. You're right. That is a practical shot. I'm pulling back the tape. I thought it was a camera trick the first time I saw it, but now I can see
and
it.
It's like, it's real. And he wanted like the actor on top. It wasn't just like hanging from a wire, like maybe a stick or a pole.
You can kind of tell by Tom Cruise's eye, his eyes kind of like wigging out. Like your eye would do if like something's in your face, like if you put up even your hand to your eye, like your eye kind of starts to blink instinctively.
That's what my eye does when I put my contacts on every morning. So
yeah, same. It's like a battle every day. I kind of feel like Ethan Hunt now, just like. Well, gentlemen, I think it's time we bring up the old kick the gun sand move. Which is probably one of the most fantastical moves in the film. It's effective in the moment. It's a nice, good, like, he didn't double tap. De Grey wakes up from the kick he had. Like, Ethan, he says, should have killed me.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought The Rock took him out, and I guess that did it. I had, like, a note, like, I thought it was done. I thought that's how we would die. It was just... rock to the back of the head.
It was a good surprise for me. It was it was good. And of course, in the meantime, Luther and Billy had gotten Naya. I can't believe Billy didn't die in this movie.
I know.
How did he not die? It's pretty impressive that he didn't. But then Sean wakes up and, you know, says, should have killed me. And then Ethan senses him. And then trying to think of the science behind this, he winks at Luther, he tosses him the vial, and he kicks. He does like in golf, like, you know, I spent a lot of time in the bunker when I play golf, which is not much. You're supposed to like hit the sand. Mike, are you going to let me keep going on this? Can you give me some sort of semblance?
Yeah, you want to dig under it.
You want to dig under it. So you want to hit the sand before you hit the ball. Is that correct, Mike?
I wasn't listening to you because I'm queuing up my next comment.
Anyways, so I feel like that's the same science behind it, is he kicked the sand and the momentum pushed up the gun into his hand.
Did his foot go under that? Though, or was it less like kick next to it and it pops up?
I think it's more of like I don't have a whiteboard, but you think about like I've got like the gun is like sitting on a rock, okay?
Yeah.
And Ethan's foot comes down and it kicks it up into the air. It. Yep.
But it goes straight up though, Mike. It doesn't even turn.
It like levitates practically.
Yeah, you know, sometimes physics is weird.
He uses the force. Yeah, it's really hard to tell like exactly what he does.
Bellerophon is actually a vaccine. It's actually midichlorians and
oh, yes, it's midichlorians, and that's why. But it's cool because he turns falls. And gets the bad guy.
Do you guys remember the SNL sketch called
Dear Sister?
Yes.
Yeah.
That is what this. What you say?
It is. It's the same kind of shot.
Most of the times that Ethan uses a gun, he's like on his shoulder on the ground.
On
like
the ground, a times. Doing it to yeah. your sister. Yeah, yeah.
Most of the time. Yeah, which is why they stop letting him have guns in future movies, probably.
Yes, yes. It's not the best. So, anything else of the sand fight? Because Naya gets healed by the magic green antidote. And all is well. No takeover, no pharmaceutical takeover. Do we find? No. Do we know what happens to Brendan Gleeson's character, the CEO? I guess he gets away, right?
Didn't he still like send a bunch? Like they got something out of him.
Like, he sent the money.
He sent the money. Maybe he's just a little bit poorer. Well, maybe he's just on Ambrose's level now for future movies.
Well, I guess Ambrose technically was the CEO, like he had the most amount of shares, but like yeah. he probably didn't like he didn't legally have a beneficiary. So that probably is going to go to like an arbitration court. It's going to get messy. That's for a new Paramount Plus miniseries, spinoff series. It's going to be all court arbitration pharmaceutical CEO. It's going to be thrilling. So anyways, Hunt goes back to Anthony Hopkins, and Anthony Hopkins asks where's the disease in the anecdote?
Not interesting. The anecdote.
The disease.
Not the anecdote.
Right?
No, the antidote. No, he gets the anecdote from Hunt on like what happens, but the antidote is what he's looking for.
Yeah, he wanted a story.
I studied journalism. Yeah. I did not study any kind of science in school, so I'm more. Which
somewhere,
is kind of.
I feel like that's those are Jason Mraz lyrics somewhere, right?
Yes.
The anecdote about the antidote.
The antidote about the antidote. Da, 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 da. Zipping it up, do do.
Won't worry my life.
Oh my goodness! That's a nice little hint that, as we will see in the future films, IMF cannot the higher ups of IMF not to be trusted. So this is a little tease for us as we move along the franchise, because there's a lot of shady stuff that happens in the upper echelon of IMF.
Do you think that they knew that? Because that scene is really awkwardly, even more tense than the previous time we see Hopkins. It's like this weird, weird tension between the two. Like the gravitas, like you were talking about, Luke, is definitely there, but it's even harder. Do you think they knew, like, okay, we're going to do this in the future with IMF?
I don't know if they knew. It is weird because, like, yeah, maybe they did, or they wanted to separate. They wanted to show that Ethan is, it's not about the mission and it's about the girl. But I don't know. It doesn't make sense to have even bring in Anthony Hopkins.
It really doesn't make sense when you start to consider, I know, I don't want to get too far into spoilers, but this romance doesn't even last another scene. So it doesn't make sense that like Ethan would like sacrifice IMF for the girl. And then the next time we see Ethan Hunt is like, he's engaged to somebody else.
Yeah. It's a big shift. I mean, we'll talk about it when we get to 3, but there's another huge tonal shift. Once we get to Mission Impossible 3, because this movie was not, it made a lot of money, but it was not,
it didn't make
well
a lot
received.
Of people go woo.
Except me.
Except Woo Boy.
Except Woo Boy. Yeah,
it's interesting. We'll have to track that. It would be interesting if they would have kept Anthony Hopkins as IMF leader moving forward. But I don't know if they intentionally set it up, if not, but it was a interesting thing to have at the end. It feels like they shot this either at the start or at the end, and they kept it, but didn't. There wasn't really a need for it. It was just a strange tonal shift. And maybe IMF wanted it as a weapon. Who knows? Or maybe they were pulling the strings the whole time. You never know. You never know.
I don't know. I never watched another one.
After this. Zach's world, it's like, this is it. It's Naya and Hunt retire in Australia and they're happily married forever and ever.
In my head, that this movie actually, Tom Cruise fell off of that the rock that he was climbing, and this is just like those last 15 seconds before he dies, like one last like legendary fever dream for him.
And that's I like the end
that. Of Ethan Hunt, in my opinion, yeah,
I like this that. I like that as a theory. Like,
legendary thing, yeah.
This would be his ideal, like. It makes sense why we'd have the force, like he would have midichlorians to be able to pull that gun off in his fever dream. Yeah. The final shot. Wow. We are in the Sydney Harbor at a park. There is not a festival, but just an absurd amount of people at the park. There's clowns. Well, no, there's not clowns, but there's people juggling fire.
That's right.
There is balloons everywhere. There's kites. I work for an Australian company, and I might have to ask them if this is like a normal day at the park where there's people doing acrobatic stuff and juggling things. But essentially, he's going on vacation, and she's in the park.
Yeah. They just had to get the fire in there because, I mean, we didn't really cover this too much. But it's just about fire. Everything's on fire.
That's true.
Man on fire.
All the fire. There's so much fire. A lot of warmth. A lot of orange tones. And it's kind of our last fire. Last sun. We got sunlight. There's Ethan. Kind of just like approaches her. Like he's almost like he's approaching an object or I feel like you know in horse movies where like the cowboy's like gonna like it's the horse that bear with me.
No, the horse, I hear you.
Like the horse is like you can't break this horse. It's a wild horse. He kind of approaches it like I'm gonna take care of this horse. I don't know. It's just like he just comes in very creepily.
Like Aragorn in the stables and Rohan, like
yes, very much, very much, yes. Yeah. I felt like he was gonna start to speak Elvish to her, and he says an interesting closing line: "Let's get lost." No, let's get lost. In contrast to Mike's idea that the rock climbing scene could have been an Apple commercial, I feel like this could have been a Travelocity commercial. Or something like that, like Travelocity. Let's get lost.
Priceline. Around that time, you know.
Let's get lost.
Captain Kirk or Will Shatner would come. Billy Shatner would come out.
Yep, more fire, and we get a nice crane shot of the park and the Sydney Bay and the Opera House. So, I do have to say they really got the Australian landscape. Nailed. They got their Sydney Opera House shots, and then it fades into the Mission Impossible theme, and that is Mission Impossible 2. Any last thoughts before we get to ranking this one? Any last words of wisdom?
Yeah. I like this movie, for the parts. Yeah. I think it's fun. I like it for not the parts that you want it for. Like, not for the fight scenes. Like, it's not, like, it does a really bad job at a lot of stuff, but there are good scenes that I really like. And I don't know, Mike, what do you think?
I think I would love this movie a whole lot more. Like, I still like it, but I will never like watch it outside of like an endeavor to watch all of them through. Right. So I only ever watch this if I know I'm going to be watching every single one of them. But I would like it a whole lot more if it was maybe an hour and a half. If it was this outrageous, but it was a tight hour and a half, I think I would really love this movie.
That's why the TV edit is so good, because it is it's an hour and a half with the TV edit. I feel like if you cut a little bit of the Spanish villa dancing scene, or you cut out the car chase. And it's a pretty tight movie. It's there. I see what you're saying. Like, if it's an hour, because I think it's a really fun movie. It's an easy watch. There's not a ton of points besides the start where I'm like, okay, what's like, it's not, it doesn't drag too bad. Maybe a little bit at the house, but
yeah. Well, we had to see how impoverished Ambrose was. I would probably actually, I would either get rid of either the bunker or the beach scene. I know they're kind of, that might be a hot take. I think I'd keep bunker, get rid of, like, cut beach in half or something like that.
That's a good idea. Just simplify it.
Yeah, I think that's where I would kind of, it feels like the same, too much of the same thing. And I really like bunker a lot. I think that develops really well.
I do beach, too.
I know they were trying to do some Bruce Lee stuff with the beach scene, the beach fight scene, but it doesn't connect as well. I think Ethan could have done that with a bunch of pigeons around him. And
come to think of it,
basement.
You never really see Ambrose eat in this movie, so I don't know if he could afford food.
No, the kitchen was not stocked. They were doing ramen and Vegemite, probably. Actually, there's a lot of Vegemite. It was a steady diet of Vegemite. The guy's so lean. Everyone is in his team so lean. They're all like really skinny, tall guys. It's rough out there. But like, if you're gonna grow a business, if you want to do a big takeover, if you're trying to start something from scratch and really transform a pharmaceutical company, you gotta hustle. You gotta put in the work. You gotta sacrifice. You gotta sacrifice your relationships. You gotta sacrifice living in a styrofoam house. You gotta sacrifice your cars that you drive. It's all those things that sacrifice to take over a pharmaceutical company and cause a pandemic. And for that, Sean Ambrose gave it his best, but failed miserably. Okay, we're going to rank this thing. So how we rank these, Zach, is by masks. Since Mission Impossible, one of the biggest tropes, besides SD cards, is...
We're open to suggestions, too. We're open to suggestions.
Is out of five masks, how would you rate this? If you have a better suggestion, we are willing to adapt.
From what I understand, it has the most mask rips off in any of them. So I struggle with it, but I'm going to try and keep to theme. I would say, in general, without knowing anything that happens after this with Ethan, I would say it's like a 3.5, probably like 3.5 masks to maybe a 4. I think I'll stick with a strong 3.5.
3.5 masks.
If I can do half masks.
You can do half masks.
Cool.
Mike, yeah. I should have written down what we did for Mission Impossible. Did we do 4? 5? I think we did 5s. Right. 4s no, or 5s? Did we 2 4s, right? We didn't
get 5s out. Yeah, I wouldn't have given a 5 out because I'm saving my 5.
Oh, I think we both did 4 for Mission Impossible. So what would you give Mission Impossible 2 out of 5 masks?
I would give it like a 2.75. I'm stuck between 2.5 and 3.
No, we're not doing that much. 2.5. 2.5 masks for...
Do you round down or round up on these things?
It's your preference.
I always appreciate it when a teacher rounded up. So I'll round up to a 3, but honestly, I feel like it's a 2.5.
Wow, that's pretty good. 3?
Yeah, we're grading on a curve here, Mike. So I think you're good, actually. You're going to get that 3.
I will also do 3 masks. Actually, you know what? I'm going to do 2.5.
Yeah, give me your reasons why. Like, why are you going down? Because
I want to give myself variation as we move forward.
Yeah, I'm going down to 2.5 as well.
The whole point was so we had differentiation.
Okay, he's got to establish a strong base for future guests.
Mike's doing 2.5 because I think I like this movie more than him. And we need some variation. So I'll do 3 masks.
Undoubtedly, you like this movie more than me.
Yes. So if you could follow that, Zach was 3.5 masks. I was 3 masks. And Mike was 2.5 masks out of 5.
You know what? Can I bump it? Can I go 4? Yeah. Here's why. Yes. I'm going to give it the extra half mask.
John Woo, baby.
I'm going to give it the extra half mask because... there is some really good technical achievements in here. There's like some really cool... like. cutting, editing, much better than other Suicide Squads, like the Suicide Squad. Much better. Yeah. But also on top of it, I think that there are some cool things that just didn't get uncovered as well. And I'm going to give it that extra half because I don't like doing half stars if it doesn't mean that I just don't, as a guest, I think I need to support this movie more.
I think honestly. You do. As a woo boy, I think you need to. I think that's only fitting.
In fact, as far as I am aware, you sought out. We were already going to invite you on, but you said, I want the second movie.
He was clear. I literally said it. We did bury that lead, but he was clear that he wanted this movie, and he has brought the goods. He has brought the woo energy. He's brought the fire. He's brought the doves. He's brought the pigeon. He's brought the action. He's brought the long hair. He's brought the climbing. He's brought the Sean Ambrose financial issues. Zach, what are your final thoughts on Mission Impossible 2?
I think it only goes up from here, guys. I think it's a strong second. It definitely goes in an opposite direction. I understand why you wouldn't go back, but in my head canon, this is a different kind of movie, and there's a reason for it. And that's just so we can make Ethan Hunt look good. Just get that standard going. So I think it does a good job.
Mike, final thoughts on Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, I'm fine with it. It's my least favorite Mission Impossible, but I don't think that's like a hot take. I think most Mission Impossible fans probably feel that way in general, without disparaging the movie entirely. So
I love this movie for a lot of reasons. I think it's very fun. I think it's an easy one to watch. I think it's different than the rest of the franchise. It's definitely a standout. Something we didn't talk about is, out of most action franchises, Mission Impossible really allows auteurs to put their stamp on films. Now, the Bond movies have done that in the last probably 20 years. They've done that more. But Mission Impossible, really since the first one, they've let the directors have a lot of leeway in how they want the vision of the film. And this is a John Woo movie. I mean, it is. It is more of a John Woo movie than a Mission Impossible movie, which I think is interesting. So if you put it in the context of 90s action of John Woo, I think it's not my favorite 90s action movie, but it still hits in a lot of fun ways. I think now that we know a little bit more about the production, I think if you did a couple things, we could start the petition now, release the Woo cut. Let's get it going. There's a 3.5-hour cut of this movie somewhere in the vaults of Paramount. Release the Woo cut. You could have either, if you shortened it or added a little bit more contextual clues, I think it could be even better. But overall, you're just having a lot of fun if you're watching this movie. You're not gonna be upset if you're watching this movie.
I would just like to say something to our audience who are watching these movies with us for the first time. If you came away from the first movie and the datedness of the technology kind of like didn't draw you in, and then now you're getting into the second movie and you're like, man, this one wasn't very good. It gets so much better. Yes. So if you're like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this podcast impossible thing with these guys. First movie I was all right with, but as dated. Second movie I was not feeling it. Trust me, we're in for a wild ride.
It almost restarts. The franchise restarts in Mission Impossible 3, and it starts flying in a fun way. It's a really good point, Mike, that I'm glad you made, because after this movie, there was a lot of questions that the franchise was going to be done. Until a beautiful man named J.J. Abrams, who created some of the best television shows of all time, stepped in to resurrect, not his first franchise he's resurrected in his career, but he comes in to help save Mission Impossible. Can he pull it off? Can he pull off the impossible mission to follow up a John Woo movie? We will find out in the next episode as we self-destruct. Zach, thanks again for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys so much. This was an awesome experience. I love sitting with you guys and just developing weird theories about the movies that we get to talk over, such as like the extended universe of the Fast and the Furious meshing with Jurassic Park last time.
Yes, this time, still gonna happen.
I hope you guys can walk away with at least an unrecognizable, forgettable villain of a movie. Now you just you'll remember it a little longer. I sure will. So thank you guys for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Mike, any final words?
Thanks for joining us, Zach. It was a joy.
All right, we will talk to you for Mission Impossible 3 coming up. Least Important Things is a podcast about the most important of the least important things in pop culture and entertainment. You can be part of the show by leaving a voicemail at www.speakpipe.com/least important things or visiting our website at leastimportantthings.com and clicking the Leave a Voicemail button. You can email the show at leastimportantthings@gmail.com or reach out to me on Instagram or Twitter at Luke H. Ferris or Least Important Things on Facebook. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'll talk to you soon.